inquiring. He doesn't recognize this number. I immediately start crying when he speaks. I cover my mouth and try to quiet myself.
Lily?
His voice is much louder now.
Lily, where are you?
I hate myself because he knows the tears are mine. Atlas, I whisper. I need help.
Where are you?
He says again. I can hear panic in his voice. I can hear him walking, moving stuff around. I hear a door slam on his end of the phone. I'll text you, I whisper, too scared to keep speaking. I don't want Ryle to wake up. I hang up the phone and somehow find the strength to still my hands while I text him my address and the access code for entry. Then I send a second text that says, "Text me when you get here. Please don't knock." I crawl to the kitchen and find my pants, struggling back into them. I find my shirt on the counter. When I'm dressed, I go to the living room. I debate opening the door and meeting Atlas downstairs, but I'm too scared I won't be able to make it down to the lobby alone. My forehead is still bleeding, and I feel too weak to even stand up and wait by the door. I slide to the floor, clenching my phone in my shaky fist and staring at it, waiting for his text. It's an agonizing 24 minutes later when my phone lights up.
Here.
I scramble to my feet and swing open the door. Arms wrap around me and my face is pressed against something soft. I just start crying and crying and shaking and crying.
Lily,
he whispers. I've never heard my name spoken so sadly. He urges me to look up at him. His blue eyes scroll over my face, and I see it happen. I watch the concern vanish as he darts his head up to the apartment door.
Is he still in there?
Rage. I can feel the rage come off of him, and he starts to step toward the apartment door. I grab his jacket in my fists. No, please, Atlas, I just want to leave. I see the pain roll over him as he pauses, struggling to decide whether to listen to me or bust through the door. He eventually turns away from the door and wraps his arms around me. He helps me to the elevator and then through the lobby. By some miracle, we only run into one person, and he's on his phone and facing the other direction. By the time we make it to the parking garage, I start to feel dizzy again. I tell him to slow down, and then I feel his arm wrap under my knees as he picks me up. Then we're in the car. Then the car is moving. I know I need stitches. I know he's taking me to the hospital. But I have no idea why the next words out of my mouth are, "Don't take me to Mass General. Take me somewhere else." For whatever reason, I don't want to risk the chance of running into any of Ryle's colleagues. I hate him. I hate him in this moment more than I've ever hated my father. But concern for his career still somehow breaks through the hatred. When I realize this, I hate myself just as much as I hate him. Chapter 24. Atlas is standing on the other side of the room. He hasn't taken his eyes off me the entire time the nurse has been helping me. After taking a blood sample, she immediately returned and began to attend to my cut. She hasn't asked me very many questions yet, but it's obvious my injuries are the result of an attack. I can see the pitying look on her face as she cleans up blood from the bite mark left on my shoulder. When she's finished, she glances back at Atlas. She steps to the right, blocking his view of me as she turns and faces me again. I need to ask you some personal questions. I'm going to ask him to leave the room, okay? It's in that moment that I realize she thinks Atlas is the one who did these things to me. I immediately start to shake my head. It wasn't him, I tell her. Please don't make him leave. Relief washes over her face. She nods her head and then pulls up a chair. Are you hurt anywhere else? I shake my head because she can't fix all the parts of me Ryle broke on the inside. Lily, her voice is gentle. Were you raped? Tears fill my eyes, and I see Atlas roll across the wall, pressing his forehead against it. The nurse waits until I make eye contact with her again to continue speaking. We have a certain examination for these situations. It's called a SANE exam. It's optional, of course, but I highly encourage it in your situation. I wasn't raped, I say. He didn't... Are you sure, Lily? The nurse asks. I nod. I don't want one. Atlas faces me again, and I can see the pain in his expression as he steps forward. Lily, you need this. His eyes are pleading. I shake my head again. Atlas, I swear. I squeeze my eyes shut and lower my head. I'm not covering for him this time, I whisper. He tried, but then he stopped. If you choose to press charges, you'll need... I don't want the exam, I say again, my voice firm. There's a knock on the door and a doctor enters, sparing me from more pleading looks from Atlas. The nurse gives the doctor a brief rundown of my injuries. She then steps aside as he examines my head and shoulder. He flashes a light into both of my eyes. He looks down at the paperwork again and says, I'd like to rule out a concussion, but given your situation, I don't want to administer a CT. We'd like to keep you for observation instead. Why don't you want to administer a CT? I ask him. The doctor stands up. We don't like to perform X-rays on pregnant women unless it's vital. We'll monitor you for complications, and if there are no further concerns, you'll be free to go.
I don't hear anything beyond that. Nothing. The pressure begins to build in my head, my heart, my stomach. I grip the edges of the exam table I'm sitting on and I stare at the floor until they both leave the room. When the door closes behind them, I sit, suspended in frozen silence. I see Atlas move closer. His feet are almost touching mine. His fingers brush lightly over my back.
Did you know?
I release a quick breath and then drag in more air. I start shaking my head, and when his arms come down around me, I cry harder than I knew my body was even capable of. He holds me the entire time I cry. He holds me through my hatred. I did this to myself. I allowed this to happen to me. I am my mother. I want to leave, I whisper.
Atlas pulls back.
They want to monitor you, Lily. I think you should stay.
I look up at him and shake my head. I need to get out of here, please. I want to leave.
He nods and helps me back into my shoes. He pulls off his jacket and wraps it around me, then we walk out of the hospital without anyone noticing. He says nothing to me as we drive. I stare out the window, too exhausted to cry, too in shock to speak. I feel submerged. Just keep swimming. Atlas doesn't live in an apartment. He lives in a house, a small suburb outside of Boston called Wellesley, where all the homes are beautiful, sprawling, manicured, and expensive. Before we pull into his driveway, I wonder to myself if he ever married that girl, Cassie. I wonder what she'll think of her husband bringing home a girl he once loved who has just been attacked by her own husband. She'll pity me. She'll wonder why I never left him. She'll wonder how I let myself get to this point. She'll wonder all the same things I used to wonder about my own mother when I saw her in my same situation. People spend so much time wondering why the women don't leave. Where are all the people who wonder why the men are even abusive? Isn't that where the only blame should be placed? Atlas parks in the garage. There's not another vehicle here. I don't wait for him to help me out of the car. I open the door and get out on my own, and then I follow him into his house. He punches in a code on an alarm and then flips on a few lights. My eyes roam around the kitchen, the dining room, the living room. Everything is made of rich woods and stainless steel, and his kitchen is painted a calming bluish green, the color of the ocean. If I wasn't hurting so much, I would smile. Atlas kept swimming, and look at him now. He swam all the way to the fucking Caribbean. He moves to his refrigerator and pulls out a bottle of water, walking it over to me. He takes the lid off and hands it to me. I take a drink and watch as he turns the living room light on, then the hallway. "Do you live alone?" I ask. He nods as he walks back into the kitchen. "Are you hungry?" I shake my head. Even if I was, I wouldn't be able to eat. "I'll show you your room," he says. "There's a shower, if you need it." I do. I want to wash the taste of scotch out of my mouth. I want to wash the sterile smell of the hospital off of me. I want to wash away the last 4 hours of my life. I follow him down the hallway into a spare bedroom where he flips on the light. There are 2 boxes on a bare bed and more stacked up against the walls. There's an oversized chair against one wall facing the door. He moves to the bed and takes off the boxes, setting them against the wall with the others. "I just moved in a few months ago. Haven't had much time to decorate yet." He walks to a dresser and pulls open a drawer. "I'll make the bed for you." He takes out sheets and a pillowcase. He begins making the bed as I walk inside the bathroom and close the door. I remain in the bathroom for 30 minutes. Some of those minutes are spent staring at my reflection in the mirror. Some of those minutes are spent in the shower. The rest are spent over the toilet as I make myself sick with thoughts of the last several hours. I'm wrapped in a towel when I crack the bathroom door. Atlas is no longer in the bedroom, but there are clothes folded on the freshly made bed. Men's pajama bottoms that are too big for me, and a t-shirt that goes past my knees. I pull the drawstring tight, tie it, and then crawl into bed. I turn the lamp off and pull the covers up and over me. I cry so hard I don't even make a noise. Chapter 25. I smell toast. I stretch out on my bed and smile because Ryle knows toast is my favorite. My eyes flick open and the clarity smashes down on me with the force of a head-on collision. I squeeze my eyes shut when I realize where I am and why I'm here, and that the toast I smell is not at all because my sweet and caring husband is making me breakfast in bed. I immediately want to cry again, so I force myself off the bed. I focus on the hollowness in my stomach as I use the bathroom and tell myself I can cry after I eat something. I need to eat before I make myself sick again. When I walk out of the bathroom and back into the bedroom, I notice the chair has been turned so that it's facing the bed now instead of the door. There's a blanket thrown over it haphazardly, and it's obvious Atlas was in here last night while I slept. He was probably worried I had a concussion. When I walk into the kitchen, Atlas is moving back and forth between the fridge, the stove, the counter. For the first time in 12 hours, I feel an inkling of something that isn't agony, because I remember he's a chef, a good one, and he's cooking me breakfast. He glances up at me as I make my way into the kitchen.
"Morning,"
he says, careful to say it without too much inflection.
"I hope you're hungry."
He slides a glass and a container of orange juice across the counter toward me,
Then he turns and faces the stove again.
I am.
He glances back over his shoulder and gives me a ghost of a smile. I pour myself a glass of orange juice and then walk to the other side of the kitchen where there's a breakfast nook. There's a newspaper on the table, and I begin to pick it up. When I see the article about the best businesses in Boston printed across the page, my hands immediately begin to shake, and I drop the paper back on the table. I close my eyes and take a slow sip of the orange juice. A few minutes later, Atlas sets a plate down in front of me, then claims the seat across from me at the table. He pulls his own plate of food in front of him and cuts into a crepe with his fork. I look down at my plate. 3 crepes, drizzled in syrup and garnished with a dab of whipped cream. Orange and strawberry slices line the right side of the plate. It's almost too pretty to eat, but I'm too hungry to care. I take a bite and close my eyes, trying not to make it obvious that it's the best bite of breakfast I've ever had. I finally allow myself to admit that his restaurant deserved that award. As much as I tried to talk Ryle and Elisa out of going back, it was the best restaurant I'd ever been to. "Where did you learn to cook?" I ask him. He sips from a cup of coffee.
"The Marines," he says, placing the cup back down. "I trained for a while during my first stint, and then when I re-enlisted, I came on as a chef."
He taps his fork against the side of his plate.
"You like it?"
I nod. "It's delicious. But you're wrong. You knew how to cook before you enlisted." He smiles.
"You remember the cookies?"
I nod again. "Best cookies I've ever eaten." He leans back in his chair.
"I taught myself the basics. My mother worked second shift when I was growing up, so if I wanted dinner at night, I had to make it. It was either that or starve, so I bought a cookbook at a yard sale and made every single recipe in it over the course of a year. And I was only 13.
I smile, shocked that I'm even able to. The next time someone asks you how you learned to cook, you should tell them that story, not the other one. He shakes his head.
"You're the only person who knows anything about me before the age of 19. I'd like to keep it that way."
He begins telling me about working as a chef in the military, how he saved up as much money as he could so that when he got out, he could open his own restaurant. He started with a small cafe that did really well, then opened Bibbs 1.5 years ago.
"It does okay," he says with modesty.
I glance around his kitchen and then look back at him. Looks like it does more than just okay. He shrugs and takes another bite of his food. I don't talk after that as we finish eating because my mind wanders to his restaurant. The name of it. What he said in the interview. Then, of course, those thoughts lead me back to the thoughts of Ryle and the anger in his voice as he yelled the last line of the interview at me. I think Atlas can see the change in my demeanor, but he says nothing as he clears the table. When he takes another seat, he chooses the chair right next to me this time. He places a reassuring hand on top of mine.
"I have to go into work for a few hours," he says. "I don't want you to leave. Stay here as long as you need, Lily. Just please don't go back home today."
I shake my head when I hear the concern in his words. "I won't. I'll stay here," I tell him. "I promise."
"Do you need anything before I go?"
I shake my head. "I'll be fine." He stands up and grabs his jacket.
"I'll make it as quick as I can. I'll be back after lunch and I'll bring you something to eat, okay?"
I force a smile. He opens a drawer and pulls out a pen and paper. He writes something on it before he leaves. When he's gone, I stand up and walk to the counter to read what he wrote. He listed instructions for how to set the alarm. He wrote his cell phone number, even though I have it memorized. He also wrote down his work number, his home address, and his work address. At the bottom, in small print, he wrote, "Just keep swimming, Lily."
Dear Ellen,
hi, it's me, Lily Bloom. Well, technically it's Lily Kincaid now. I know it's been a long time since I've written to you. A really long time. After everything that happened with Atlas, I just couldn't bring myself to open up the journals again. I couldn't even bring myself to watch your show after school because it hurt to watch it alone. In fact, all thoughts of you kind of depressed me. When I thought of you, I thought of Atlas. And to be honest, I didn't want to think of Atlas, so I had to cut you out of my life, too. I'm sorry about that. I'm sure you didn't miss me like I missed you, but sometimes the things that matter to you most are also the things that hurt you the most. And in order to get over that hurt, you have to sever all the extensions that keep you tethered to that pain. You were an extension of my pain, so I guess that's what I was doing. I was just trying to save myself a little bit of agony. I'm sure your show is as great as ever, though. I hear you still dance at the beginning of some episodes, but I've grown to appreciate that. I think that's one of the biggest signs a person has matured, knowing how to appreciate things that matter to others, even if they don't matter very much to you. I should probably catch you up on my life. My father died. I'm 24 now. I got a college degree, worked in marketing for a while, and now I own my own business. A floral shop. Life Goals, FTW. I also have a husband, and he isn't Atlas. And I live in Boston. I know. Shocker. The last time I wrote to you, I was 16. I was in a really bad place, and I was so worried about Atlas. I'm not worried about Atlas anymore, but I am in a really bad place right now. More so than the last time I wrote to you. I'm sorry I don't seem to need to write to you when I'm in a good place. You tend to only get the shit end of my life, but that's what friends are for, right? I don't even know where to start. I know you don't know anything about my current life or my husband, Ryle. But there's this thing we do where one of us says naked truth, and then we're forced to be brutally honest and say what we're really thinking. So, naked truth. Brace yourself. I am in love with a man who physically hurts me. Of all people, I have no idea how I let myself get to this point. There were many times growing up I wondered what was going through my mother's head in the days after my father had hurt her. How she could possibly love a man who had laid his hands on her. A man who repeatedly hit her, repeatedly promised he would never do it again, repeatedly hit her again. I hate that I can empathize with her now. I've been sitting on Atlas's couch for over 4 hours wrestling with my feelings. I can't get a grip on them. I can't understand them. I don't know how to process them, and true to my past, I realize that maybe I need to just get them out on paper. My apologies to you, Ellen, but get ready for a whole lot of word vomit. If I had to compare this feeling to something, I would compare it to death. Not just the death of anyone. The death of the one. The person who is closer to you than anyone else in the whole world. The one who, when you simply imagine their death, it makes your eyes tear up. That's what this feels like. It feels like Ryle has died. It's an astronomical amount of grief. An enormous amount of pain. It's a sense that I've lost my best friend, my lover, my husband, my lifeline. But the difference between this feeling and death is the presence of another emotion that doesn't necessarily follow in the event of an actual death. Hatred. I am so angry at him, Ellen. Words can't express the amount of hatred I have for him. Yet somehow, in the midst of all my hatred, there are waves of reasoning that flow through me. I start to think things like, but I shouldn't have had the magnet. I should have told him about the tattoo from the beginning. I shouldn't have kept the journals. The reasoning is the hardest part of this. It eats at me, little by little, wearing down the strength my hatred lends to me. The reasoning forces me to imagine our future together, and how there are things I could do to prevent that type of anger. I'll never betray him again. I'll never keep secrets from him again. I'll never give him reason to react that way again. We'll both just have to work harder from now on. For better or for worse, right? I know these are the things that once went through my mother's head. But the difference between the two of us is that she had more to worry about. She didn't have the financial stability that I have. She didn't have the resources to leave and give me what she thought was a decent shelter. She didn't want to take me away from my father when I was used to living with both parents. I have a feeling reasoning really kicked her ass a time or two. I can't even begin to process the thought that I'm having a child with this man. There is a human being inside of me that we created together. And no matter which option I choose, whether I choose to stay or choose to leave, neither are choices I would wish upon my child. To grow up in a broken home or an abusive one. I've already failed this baby in life, and I've only known about his or her existence for a single day. Ellen, I wish you could write back to me. I wish that you could say something funny to me right now, because my heart needs it. I have never felt this alone, this broken, this angry, this hurt. People on the outside of situations like these often wonder why the woman goes back to the abuser. I read somewhere once that 85% of women return to abusive situations. That was before I realized I was in one. And when I heard that statistic, I thought it was because the women were stupid. I thought it was because they were weak. I thought these things about my own mother more than once. But sometimes the reason women go back is simply because they're in love. I love my husband, Ellen. I love so many things about him. I wish cutting my feelings off for the person who hurt me was as easy as I used to think it would be. Preventing your heart from forgiving someone you love is actually a hell of a lot harder than simply forgiving them. I'm a statistic now. The things I've thought about women like me are now what others would think of me if they knew my current situation. How could she love him after what he did to her? How could she contemplate taking him back? It's sad that those are the first thoughts that run through our minds when someone is abused. Shouldn't there be more distaste in our mouths for the abusers than for those who continue to love the abusers? I think of all the people who have been in this situation before me. Everyone who will be in this situation after me. Do we all repeat the same words in our heads in the days after experiencing abuse at the hands of those who love us? From this day forward, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and health, until death do us part. Maybe those vows weren't meant to be taken as literally as some spouses take them. For better, for worse, fuck that shit. Lily. Chapter 26. I'm lying on Atlas's guest bed, staring up at the ceiling. It's a normal bed, really comfortable, actually. But it feels like I'm on a waterbed, or maybe a raft adrift at sea. And I scale over these huge waves, each of them carrying something different. Some are waves of sadness, some are waves of anger. Some are waves of tears. Some are waves of sleep. Occasionally, I'll place my hands on my stomach, and a tiny wave of love will come.
I have no idea how I can already love something so much, but I do. I think about whether or not it'll be a boy or a girl, and what I'll name it. I wonder if it will look like me or Ryle. And then another wave of anger will come and crash down on that tiny wave of love. I feel robbed of the joy a mother should have when she finds out she's pregnant. I feel like Ryle took that from me last night, and it's just one more thing I have to hate him for. Hatred is exhausting. I force myself off the bed and into the shower. I've been in my room most of the day. Atlas returned home several hours ago, and I heard him open the door at one point to check on me, but I pretended to be asleep. I feel awkward being here. Atlas is the very reason Ryle was angry at me last night, yet he's the one I ran to when I needed help. Being here fills me with guilt, maybe even a little bit of shame, as though my calling Atlas lends credibility to Ryle's anger. But there's literally nowhere I can go right now. I need a couple of days to process things, and if I go to a hotel, Ryle could track the credit card charge and find me. He'd be able to find me at my mother's, at Elisa's, at Lucy's. He's even met Devon a couple of times and would more than likely go there, too. I can't see him tracking down Atlas, though. Yet. I'm sure if I go a week avoiding his calls and texts, he'll look everywhere he can possibly look to find me. But for now, I don't think he would show up here. Maybe that's why I'm here. I feel safer here than anywhere else I could possibly go, and Atlas has an alarm system, so there's that. I glance at the nightstand to look at my phone. I skip over all the missed texts from Ryle and open the one from Elisa. Elisa. Hey, Aunt Lily. They're sending us home tonight. Come see us tomorrow when you get home from work. She sent a picture of her and Riley, and it makes me smile, then cry. Damn these emotions. I wait until my eyes are dry again before I walk into the living room. Atlas is sitting at his kitchen table, working on his laptop. When he looks up at me, he smiles and closes it.
Hey.
I force a smile and then look in the kitchen. Do you have anything to eat? Atlas stands up quickly.
Yeah,
he says.
Yeah, sit down. I'll get something ready for you.
I take a seat on the couch as he works his way around the kitchen. The television is on, but it's muted. I unmute it and click on the DVR. He has a few shows recorded, but the one that catches my eye is the Ellen DeGeneres show. I smile and click on the most recent unwatched episode and hit play. Atlas brings me a bowl of pasta and a glass of ice water. He glances at the TV and then sits down next to me on the couch. For the next 3 hours, we watch a full week's worth of episodes. I laugh out loud 6 times. It feels good, but when I take a bathroom break and come back to the living room, the weight of it all starts to sink in again. I sit back down on the couch next to Atlas. He's leaning back with his feet propped up on the coffee table. I naturally lean into him, and just like he used to do when we were teenagers, he pulls me against his chest, and we just sit there in silence. His thumb brushes the outside of my shoulder, and I know it's his unspoken way of saying he's here for me, that he feels bad for me. And for the first time since he picked me up last night, I feel like talking about it. My head is resting against his shoulder, and my hands are in my lap. I'm fidgeting with the drawstring on the pants that are way too big for me. Atlas, I say, my voice barely a whisper. I'm sorry I got so angry at you that night at the restaurant. You were right. Deep down, I knew you were right, but I didn't want to believe it. I lift my head and look at him, cracking a pitiful smile. You can say I told you so now. His eyebrows draw together like my words somehow hurt him. Lily, this is not something I wanted to be right about. I prayed every day that I was wrong about him. I wince. I shouldn't have said that to him. I know better than to think Atlas would ever think something like, "I told you so." He squeezes my shoulder and leans forward, kissing the top of my head. I close my eyes as I soak up the familiarity of him, his smell, his touch, his comfort. I've never understood how someone can be so rock solid yet comforting, but that's always how I viewed him, like he could withstand anything, but somehow still feels the weight that everyone else carries. I don't like that I was never fully able to let go of him, no matter how hard I tried. I think about the fight with Ryle over Atlas's phone number. The fight about the magnet, the article, the things he read in my journal, the tattoo. None of that would have happened if I would have just let go of Atlas and thrown it all away. Ryle wouldn't have had anything to be so upset with me about. I pull my hands up to my face after that thought, upset that there's a part of me trying to blame Ryle's reaction on my lack of closure with Atlas. There's no excuse. None. This is just another wave I'm being forced to ride on, a wave of complete and utter confusion. Atlas can feel the change in my composure.
You okay?
I'm not. I'm not okay, because until this moment, I had no idea how hurt I still am that he never came back for me. If he'd have just come back for me like he promised, I would have never even met Ryle, and I would have never been in this situation. Yep, I'm definitely confused. How am I possibly lending blame to Atlas for any of this? I think I need to call it a night, I say quietly, pulling away from him. I stand up, and Atlas stands up too.
I'll be gone most of the day tomorrow, he says. Will you be here when I get home?
I cringe at his question. Of course, he wants me to get my shit together and find another place to stay. What am I even still doing here? No, I can get a hotel, it's fine. I turn to walk toward the hallway, but he puts a hand on my shoulder.
Lily, he says, turning me around. I wasn't asking you to leave. I was just making sure you'd still be here. I want you to stay as long as you need to.
His eyes are sincere, and if I didn't think it would be a little inappropriate, I would throw my arms around him and hug him. Because I'm not ready to leave yet. Just a couple more days before I'm forced to figure out what my next step is. I nod. I need to go into work for a few hours tomorrow, I tell him. There are some things I need to take care of. But if you really don't mind, I'd like to stay here for a few more days.
I don't mind, Lily. I'd prefer it.
I force a smile and then head to the guest bedroom. At least he's giving me a buffer before I'm forced to confront everything. As much as his presence in my life confuses me right now, I've never been more thankful for him. Chapter 27. My hand is trembling when I reach for the doorknob. I've never once been scared to walk into my own business before, but I've also never been this on edge. The building is dark when I enter it, so I flip on the lights, holding my breath. I walk slowly to my office, pushing the door open with caution. He's nowhere, yet he's everywhere. When I take a seat at my desk, I turn on my phone for the first time since I went to bed last night. I wanted a good night's sleep without having to worry about whether or not Ryle was trying to contact me. When it powers on, I have 29 missed texts from Ryle. It just so happens to be the same number of doors Ryle knocked on to find my apartment last year. I don't know whether to laugh or cry at the irony.
I spend the rest of the day like this, glancing over my shoulder, looking up at the door every time it opens. I wonder if he's ruined me, if the fear of him will ever leave me. Half a day goes by without a single phone call from him while I catch up on paperwork. Elisa calls me after lunch, and I can tell by her voice that she has no idea about the fight Ryle and I had. I let her talk about the baby for a while before I pretend I have a customer and hang up. I plan on leaving when Lucy returns from her lunch break. She has half an hour left. Ryle walks through the front door 3 minutes later. I'm the only one here. As soon as I see him, I turn stone cold. I'm standing behind the counter, my hand on the cash register, because it's close to the stapler. I'm sure a stapler couldn't do much harm against the arms of a neurosurgeon, but I'll use what I have. He slowly makes his way to the counter. It's the first time I've seen him since he was on top of me on our bed the other night. My whole body is immediately taken back to that moment, and I'm engulfed in the same level of emotions as I was in that moment. Both fear and anger rush through me when he reaches the counter. He lifts his hand and places a set of keys on the counter in front of me. My eyes fall to the keys.
"I'm leaving for England tonight," he says. "I'll be gone for 3 months. I paid all the bills, so you won't have to worry about it while I'm gone."
His voice is composed, but I can see the veins in his neck as they prove his composure is taking all the effort he has.
"You need time."
He swallows hard.
"And I want to give that to you."
He grimaces and pushes the keys to my apartment toward me.
"Go back home, Lily. I won't be there. I promise."
He turns and begins walking toward the door. It occurs to me that he didn't even try to apologize. I'm not angry about it. I understand it. He knows that an apology will never take back what he did. He knows that the best thing for us right now is separation. He knows what a huge mistake he made. Yet I still feel the need to dig that knife in a little deeper. "Ryle." He looks back at me, and it's as if he puts a shield up between us. He doesn't turn all the way around, and he's stiff as he waits for whatever I'm about to say. He knows my words are going to hurt him. "You know what the worst part about this whole thing is?" I ask. He doesn't say anything. He just stares at me, waiting for my answer. "All you had to do when you found my journal was ask me for a naked truth. I would have been honest with you. But you didn't. You chose to not ask for my help, and now we'll both have to suffer the consequences of your actions for the rest of our lives." He grimaces with every word.
"Lily,"
he says, turning toward me. I hold up my hand to stop him from saying anything else. "Don't. You can leave now. Have fun in England." I can see the war waging inside of him. He knows he can't get anywhere with me in this moment, no matter how hard he wants to beg for my forgiveness. He knows the only choice he has is to turn and walk out that door, even though it's the last thing he wants to do. When he finally forces himself out the door, I run and lock it. I slide down to the floor and hug my knees, burying my face against them. I'm shaking so hard I can feel my teeth chatter. I can't believe part of that man is growing inside me. And I can't believe I'll one day have to admit that to him. Chapter 28. After Ryle left me his keys this afternoon, I debated going back to our new apartment. I even had a cab pull up to the building, but I couldn't force myself out of the car. I knew if I went back there today, I'd probably see Elisa at some point. I'm not ready to explain the stitches on my forehead to her.
I'm not ready to see the kitchen where Ryle's harsh words cut through me. I'm not ready to walk into the bedroom where I was completely destroyed. So instead of returning to my own home, I took the cab back to Atlas's house. It feels like my only safe zone right now. I don't have to confront things when I'm hiding out here. Atlas has already texted me twice today checking on me, so when I get a text a few minutes before 7 o'clock in the evening, I assume it's from him. It's not. It's from Elisa. Elisa, you home from work yet? Come up and visit us. I'm already bored. My heart sinks when I read her text. She has no idea what happened between me and Ryle. I wonder if Ryle even told her he left for England today. My thumb types and erases and types some more as I try to come up with a good excuse as to why I'm not there. Me. I can't. I'm in the emergency room. Hit my head on that shelf in the storage room at work, getting stitches. I hate that I lied to her, but it'll save me from having to explain the cut and also why I'm not home right now. Elisa, oh no, are you alone? Marshall can come sit with you since Ryle is gone. Okay, so she knows Ryle left for England. That's good, and she thinks we're fine. This is good. That means I have at least 3 months before I have to tell her the truth. Look at me. Sweeping shit under the rug, just like my mother. Me. No, I'm fine. I'll be finished up by the time Marshall could even get here. I'll come by tomorrow after work. Give Riley a kiss for me. I lock the screen on my phone and set it on my bed. It's dark outside now, so I immediately see the scroll of the headlights as someone pulls into the driveway. I instantly know that it isn't Atlas because he uses the driveway to the side of the house and parks in the garage. My heart begins to race as fear rushes through me. Is it Ryle? Did he find out where Atlas lives? Moments later, there's a loud knock at the front door, more like pounding. The doorbell also rings. I tiptoe to the window and barely move the curtains over far enough to take a look outside. I can't see who's at the door, but there's a truck in the driveway. It doesn't belong to Ryle. Could it be Atlas's girlfriend? Cassie? I grab my phone and make my way down the hallway toward the living room. The pounding on the door and the chime of the doorbell are still going off simultaneously. Whoever is at the door is being ridiculously impatient. If it is Cassie, I already find her extremely annoying. Atlas, a guy yells, open the damn door. Another voice, also male, yells, my balls are freezing up. They're raisins, man. Open the door. Before I open the door and let them know Atlas isn't home, I text him, hoping he's about to pull in the driveway and deal with this himself. Me. Where are you? There are two men at your front door, and I have no idea if I should let them in. I wait through more presses of the doorbell and more pounding, but Atlas doesn't immediately text me back. I finally walk to the door and leave the chain bolted, but unlock the deadbolt and open the door a few inches. One of the guys is tall, about 6 feet or so. Despite the youthful look to his face, his hair is salt and pepper. Black with a little bit of gray sprinkled in. The other one is shorter by a few inches, with sandy brown hair and a baby face. They both look to be in their late 20s, maybe early 30s. The tall one's face twists into confusion.
Who are you?
He asks, peeking through the door. Lily, who are you? The shorter one pushes in front of the taller one. Is Atlas here? I don't want to tell them no, because then they'll know I'm here alone. I don't necessarily hold much trust in the male population this week. The phone in my hand rings, and all three of us jump from the unexpectedness of it. It's Atlas. I swipe the answer button and bring it to my ear. Hello?
It's fine, Lily. They're just friends of mine. I forgot it was Friday. We always play poker on Fridays. I'll call them now and tell them to leave.
I look back at the two of them, and they're just standing there watching me. I feel bad that Atlas feels like he has to cancel his plans just because I'm crashing at his house. I shut the door and unlock the deadbolt, then open the door again, motioning them inside. It's fine, Atlas. You don't have to cancel your plans. I was about to go to bed anyway.
No, I'm on my way. I'll have them leave.
I still have the phone pressed to my ear when the two men enter the living room. See you soon, I say to Atlas, and then end the call. The next few seconds are awkward as the guys assess me and I assess them. What are your names?
I'm Darren, the tall one says.
Brad, the shorter one says.
Lily, I say to them, even though I already told them my name. Atlas will be here soon. I move to close the door and they seem to relax a little. Darren heads into the kitchen and helps himself to Atlas's refrigerator. Brad takes off his jacket and hangs it up.
Do you know how to play poker, Lily?
I shrug. It's been a few years, but I used to play with friends in college. Both of them walk toward the dining room table.
What happened to your head?
Darren asks as he takes a seat. He asks it so casually, like it doesn't even cross his mind that it might be a sensitive subject. I don't know why I have an urge to give him the naked truth. Maybe I just want to see how someone will react when they find out my own husband did this to me. My husband happened. We got into a fight 2 nights ago and he headbutted me. Atlas took me to the emergency room. They gave me 6 stitches and told me I was pregnant. Now I'm hiding out here until I figure out what to do. Poor Darren is frozen, halfway between standing and sitting. He has no idea how to respond to that. Based on the look on his face, I think he's convinced I'm crazy. Brad pulls out his chair and takes a seat, pointing at me.
You should get some Rodan and Fields. The amp roller works wonders for scarring.
I immediately laugh at his random response. Somehow.
Jesus, Brad,
Darren says, finally sinking into his seat.
You're worse than your wife with this direct sales shit. You're like a walking infomercial.
Brad raises his hands in defense. What? He says innocently.
I'm not trying to sell her anything. I'm being honest. The stuff works. You'd know that if you'd use it on your damn acne.
Screw you,
Darren says.
It's like you're trying to be a perpetual teenager,
Brad mutters.
Acne isn't cool when you're 30.
Brad pulls out the chair next to him while Darren begins shuffling a deck of cards.
Have a seat, Lily. One of our friends decided to be an idiot and get married last week, and now his wife won't let him come to poker night anymore. You can be his fill-in until he gets a divorce.
I had every intention of hiding out in my room tonight, but these two make it hard to walk away. I take a seat next to Brad and reach across the table. Hand me those, I say to Darren. He's shuffling the cards like a one-armed infant. He raises an eyebrow and pushes the deck of cards across the table. I don't know much about card games, but I can shuffle cards like a pro. I separate the cards into 2 piles and scoot them together, pressing my thumbs to the ends, watching as they beautifully intertwine. Darren and Brad are staring at the deck of cards when there's another knock on the door. This time the door swings open without pause, and a guy walks in dressed in what looks like a very expensive tweed jacket. There's a scarf wrapped around his neck, and he begins to unwind it as soon as he slams the door behind him. He nudges his head in my direction as he walks toward the kitchen.
Who are you?
He's older than the other two, probably in his mid-40s. Atlas definitely has an interesting mix of friends.
This is Lily, Brad says. She's married to an asshole and just found out she's pregnant with the asshole's baby. Lily. This is Jimmy. He's pompous and arrogant.
Pompous and arrogant are the same thing, idiot, Jimmy says.
He pulls out the chair next to Darren and nudges his head at the cards in my hands.
Did Atlas plant you here to hustle us?
What kind of average person knows how to shuffle cards like that?
I smile and begin to pass cards out to each of them. I guess we'll have to play around to find out.
We're on our third round of bets when Atlas finally walks in. He closes the door behind him and looks around at the four of us. Brad said something funny right before Atlas opened the door, so I'm in the middle of a fit of laughter when Atlas locks eyes with me. He nods his head toward the kitchen and begins walking in that direction. "Fold," I say, laying my cards flat on the table as I stand up to follow him. When I get to the kitchen, he's standing where he isn't visible to the guys at the table. I walk over to him and lean against the counter.
"You want me to ask them to leave?"
I shake my head. "No, don't do that. I'm actually enjoying it. It's keeping my mind off things." He nods, and I can't help but notice how he smells like herbs. Rosemary, specifically. It makes me wish I could see him in action at his restaurant.
"You hungry?"
he asks. I shake my head. "Not really. I ate some leftover pasta a couple hours ago." My hands are pressed into the counter on either side of me. He takes a step closer and puts one of his hands over mine, brushing his thumb across the top of it. I know he doesn't mean for it to be anything more than a comforting gesture, but when he touches me, it feels like a whole lot more. A rush of warmth moves up my chest, and I immediately drop my eyes to our hands. Atlas pauses his thumb for a second like he feels it too. He pulls his hand away and backs up a step.
"Sorry,"
he mutters, turning toward the refrigerator, pretending to look for something. It's obvious he's trying to spare me from the awkwardness of what just happened. I walk back to the table and pick up my cards for the next round. A couple of minutes later, Atlas walks over and takes the seat next to me. Jimmy shuffles out a round of new cards to everyone.
"So, Atlas, how do you and Lily know each other?"
Atlas picks up his cards one at a time.
"Lily saved my life when we were kids,"
he says, matter of fact. He glances over at me and winks, and I drown in guilt for the way that wink makes me feel, especially at a time like this. Why is my heart doing this to me?
"Aw, that's sweet," Brad says. "Lily saved your life, now you're saving hers."
Atlas lowers his cards and glares at Brad.
"Excuse me?"
"Relax," Brad says. "Me and Lily are tight. She knows I'm kidding."
Brad looks at me.
"Your life might be complete crap right now, Lily, but it'll get better. Trust me, I've been there."
Darren laughs.
"You've been beat up and pregnant and hiding out at another man's house?"
he says to Brad. Atlas slaps his cards on the table and pushes back in his chair.
"What the hell is wrong with you?"
he yells at Darren. I reach over and squeeze his arm reassuringly. "Relax," I say. "We bonded before you got here. I actually don't mind that they're making light of my situation. It really does make it a little less heavy." He runs a frustrated hand through his hair, shaking his head.
"I'm so confused,"
he says.
"You were alone with them for 10 minutes.
I laugh. "You can learn a lot about someone in 10 minutes. I try to redirect the conversation. "So, how do you all know each other?" Darren leans forward and points at himself.
"I'm the sous chef at Bibbs."
He points at Brad.
"He's the dishwasher."
"For now," Brad interjects.
"I'm working my way up."
"What about you?" I say to Jimmy. He smirks and says,
"Take a guess."
Based on the way he dresses and the fact that he's been called arrogant and pompous, I'd have to assume...
"Maitre d'?"
Atlas laughs.
"Jimmy actually works in valet."
I glance back at Jimmy and raise an eyebrow. He tosses 3 poker chips down and says,
"It's true. I park cars for tips."
"Don't let him fool you," Atlas says.
"He works in valet, but only because he's so rich he gets bored."
I smile. It reminds me of Elisa. I have an employee like that.
Only works because she's bored. She's actually the best employee I have.
Damn straight,
Jimmy mutters. I take a look at my cards when it's my